You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
Happy to welcome back to the podcast Tony Goldsby Smith. Welcome, Tony, and it's good to get to talk to you, but these are dire times, and I thought about you because I'm wanting to get some international perspective on what's happening here in the U.S. from people that I've met through the conversation about universal reconciliation, and I keep up with the Gospel Conversations podcast, and I really enjoyed your talk at the St. James Institute.
Yes.
That you gave. And at that talk, you talked about how you can understand a system by what its goal is to produce.
Yes.
And so you understand systems from the end goal. And that got me thinking about apokatastasis and the ultimate goal of creation. And then your work in assessing the ultimate goal of government systems and business systems. And so you've got a systems perspective on this world of ours. And so I'm interested from your perspective, how you see what's going on in the world right now in the United States with authoritarianism and fascism on the rise, and your work on apokatastasis and systems analysis.
Well, just to back up a little bit and explain what I meant about understanding systems, I was referring to the famous Italian philosopher Vico. I don't know if you're familiar with Vico's work, but Vico was Descartes' great rival or antagonist. Now, Descartes, often seen as the father of the Enlightenment, and both men were Christians. So, however, Descartes' view of reality was very mechanistic, and Descartes fundamentally wanted certainty in life. He thought the only truth could be a truth that was absolutely certain, and that led him to mathematics. He didn't want ambiguity. He didn't want conversation. None of these things. I'm not saying he didn't want them in his private life. I'm saying that he didn't want them in any philosophy, because philosophy had to be about cut and dried truth. Now, that's had devastating impacts in our world. And one of the intriguing things is the way this Enlightenment project towards certainty and proof and empiricism became entangled with the church. And really was probably a bit too attractive in ways to the church, because it appeals to a sort of fundamentalist mindset, you know, that there is a certain truth and we can know it. If you think about it, that way of thinking becomes pretty intolerant if it moves into politics or even into religion. His rival, Vico, now Descartes was French, and the French tend to be fairly intelligent but very detail-minded. They're attracted to a very kind of procedural detailed view of reality. The Italians, well, you know what Italians are like, free spirits, and... So his rival about a generation later was this man, Vico, Giambattista Vico. And Vico, not as famous as Descartes, but definitely his intellectual equal and definitely a guy with a growing reputation. Vico was a humanist. He was much more trained in, let's call it, ambiguity, discussion, and open thinking, which he all attached to his faith and his religion. And very famously, his critique of Descartes was that the only way to understand any system is not by the how it works, but the why. Why does it exist? It's a very famous principle, one of Vico's very famous principles called per causa, through cause, through meaning, we could say. So therefore, to understand a system, you work backwards from its purpose. Now, he added to that a second principle, which is, and the only person who understands truly and can understand the purpose of the system is the one who made it. So if we're inside the system, we didn't make it. Now, this immediately, of course, applies to creation. God is the maker of creation, as far as he was concerned, and only God, therefore, can ever fully understand creation. And that didn't mean, by the way, that Vico said, well, let's give up and not try to understand nature. But nonetheless, that's a very important principle. I want to come back to it in a moment. If we apply that principle to systems, because we live in a world of systems. By system, I don't mean a computer system. I mean ways of working that are agreed amongst people. And it's really the heart of organization. It's the heart of organization. A lot of the work we did in Second Road was trying to help people redesign systems. Now, mostly when people try to redesign systems, they do what stupid old Elon Musk did. You know, they just go in and slash and burn, cut costs, etc. And we never took that approach. We would actually black box the system, just wrap it all up. We'll get into its workings later. What's the purpose of this system? Now, that's hard work, because purpose is not a set of cute goals and objectives. It's really, really deep. Why? For what benefit and blessing, and I did use that word even in secular context, does this system exist? And when we've clarified that, now we can go down into rethinking how it works. But that gives you what I'd call the big picture. And we could actually completely change the system. We could say the way it works just doesn't work like this. We've got to completely change it. Let me give you a very specific example. One of the largest clients I had for the longest periods of time was the Australian Tax Office, our equivalent of your Internal Revenue Department. And I was really the major consultant to the leadership of the Tax Office during their time of great change. It was a privilege to be involved because we introduced a new tax system. The tax office was under a lot of pressure. Essentially, did not have the internal resources to keep calculating tax returns. The computer systems were overloaded. The task of governing the revenue system of Australia was too big for it. Their thinking went back to, well, for what purpose does the tax office exist? For what purpose does it exist? And they clarified that purpose through discussion and through looking at the legislative act that set up the tax office. And it exists to assure the government, that the appropriate percentage of gross domestic product is being collected in taxes. One sentence. Now, what it doesn't exist to do is to collect revenues, but that's what they spent most of their time doing. That's what all their resources were in, a revenue collection organization. And they said, well, we could actually outsource that to banks or something. We don't have to do that. And that grasp of that purpose then shifted their identity and their capabilities. We have to become a knowledge organization. We're really paid to have our finger on the pulse of the economy. That's very, very different to being a transactional, you know, revenue collecting agency. Now, that's a bit of a perhaps a long example, but I'm very passionate about this because that's baked into my bones. I always felt there's something ethical about that way of thinking. It does open the door for it to be more innovative. But if I now apply that to the gospel, what is completely clear, and it's clearest in the book of Ephesians, is this is how certainly Paul felt about the gospel. For what purpose? What's the end of all things? What's the culmination of all things? And in the famous chapter one, he keeps coming back to God did this according to his will and purpose. He's made known to us his will and purpose. So you need to go to the end and work backwards. And that's what I think, that's why, as David Hart said, you know, the early Christians were eschatological. In other words, they worked from the end backwards. And that is something which will lead one to confront universal reconciliation very, very quickly. If your goal is actually framed by a torture chamber, by a judicial system that you've extrapolated out from the earth, well, then you'll come back and that's the kind of system you'll build. That's the kind of system you'll build. But if your system is a system of harmony and universal reconciliation, you'll come back and you'll see everything as to how everything works very differently.
Well, you know that Ephesians 1:10 is the idea is that everything is going to be summed up again, up, recapitulated. Anakephalaiosthai is the Greek word there. Everything will be recapitulated in Christ and will be brought to a coherent whole. So coming to that understanding then, theologically, once you become persuaded what the end of all things is, then that helps you to work backwards in your theological system to make something that's coherent and that fits together with all of that. But then inside of those of us who believe in universal reconciliation, we're inside a world where there are lots of systems that are not designed for that, people designed that are not for that purpose. And political, and I know that you've worked with, you know, political systems, government systems. I guess as you're kind of looking at the world and you look at the what's happening in the United States right now, what kind of system do you see that's trying to be constructed in the United States?
Well, that's a question that is occupying the mind of many people. And I don't have easy answers for that. Because I don't think Donald Trump is not a systematic person. He clearly isn't. But let me back up to the kind of systems that I think Jesus was the pioneer of. And let me back up even further than Jesus to creation. The great Russian theologian Bulgakov, in the beginning of one of his trilogies, has an extraordinary sentence, which, when I read it, stunned me. And that sentence is this: a great question slithers across the globe like a snake. Who will govern the earth? You know, the God-man or human ego? Roughly, that's what that sentence says. Now, a word about Bulgakov, I can identify with him because, as you probably know, just you know, yes, he's certainly in David Bentley Hart's mind, the greatest theologian of the last century or so. But leaving that aside, he was a cross-disciplinary thinker. He was a systems man. You know that, don't you? He was an eminent economist in the Leninist government. Of course, he turned against them and was expelled. But he never, ever lost his interest in social systems. And you might remember that one of the things that I talked about in my journey in the St. James Institute talk, where I tried to trace what opened me up to apocatastasis, one was the fact that I didn't live a religious life. I lived a life out in the planet amongst big systems, and I recognized that my faith demanded if I have a God, he has to be the God of these systems, not just a religious place. And that's exactly, so that leads you to a big picture of God. And I think that heritage really influenced Wilkercock. So in other words, his view of salvation was a view of government, because he believed the mandate of humanity was co-creators or sub-creators with God of civilization. We're on the planet to create, to continue Genesis 1. So Genesis 1 is, as it were, a beginning, an unfinished prelude, and we're continuing it. Now, that being the case, my quote-unquote religious interest needs to be political, small p, interested in how we run the show. How do we run the show? Now, running the show, generally speaking, the answer to that pretty universally throughout history is we run it via kingship, top-down hierarchy, controls. And that kingship, some are benevolent, some are not, but essentially it's a hierarchical system. That's all humanity can come up with. And that expression of ego is what ruined the history of Israel. And it was power in the great phrase of I think it was Lord Acton, the English politician. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's a very, very difficult thing to handle power. Very, very difficult. It's intoxicating. I don't know if you listened, but recently I gave a series of short videos that Ilaria Ramelli talking about apocatastasis with Robin Parry, and I bookended them, and she did one where she briefly mentioned Plato and Plato's view of hell. It's very, very interesting. Now, that view of hell is most clearly expounded, and I talk about it in his Platonic dialogue called the Gorgias. I think it's a soft G, Gorgias, not Gorgias, but anyway, that famous Platonic dialogue. And that's a dialogue about power. That's actually what it's about. It ends up in hell, judgment. But the prelude to it's very, very interesting, because Socrates is having an argument with a young Turk who cannot differentiate. He cannot differentiate. This is the critical issue. I mean, when I read it, it was chilling. I thought I was reading about Trump. It was like Socrates talking to Trump. He couldn't differentiate between the good and the powerful. They were synonymous to him, this young Turk. And how on earth could you even conceive of a good that was not at the same time powerful and could crush its opponents? It can't be good if it's not powerful. Socrates found that abhorrent. And the reason he wanted a judgment in hell was he wanted the kings to be judged And he makes the point that it's not necessary that kings and rulers become evil, but it's almost inevitable because of the intoxicating allure of power. So when I look at what's happening in America and I look at Trump, frankly, I view it through that lens of intoxicating power. And it's as if we have someone, I believe he's genuinely narcissistic. So I definitely believe that he's a sociopath. But we have someone who, for whom the allure of power and ego is the defining reality. And the goal is, I think, completely ego. It's me. I am the goal. And so he is, if we come through to how I evaluate him, well, we can look at Jesus Christ in several levels, but let's say level one is political. I did a tour of Israel, a historical tour of Israel with John Dixon, who's a tremendous historian Christian, and he painted the picture of Jesus in his day. And what became absolutely clear to me, Jesus was a major political figure. Because in his day, unlike today, the Pharisees, they ran the country. His opponents were not religious. They were socio-political and religious. And what we see is an alliance of church and state against him. Because he was, I wouldn't say a Democrat, but he was going to turn power upside down. And for him, how does God run the universe is the question. How does God run the universe? So we've now got a picture of God presented. You know, normally Christians say, well, holiness and righteousness, and this is true, but not really, I think, helpful to this discussion. The picture of God is he runs the show by love, and love means self-sacrifice, laying down your life. It's an upside-down view of leadership, culminating in the cross. And I think you know that David Hart sees John 19 as really the high point of the conflict. Rome, Pontius Pilate versus Jesus. Pontius Pilate as the representative of naked power, Trump-type naked power versus Jesus, who said nothing and was crucified. But was this weakness or was this glory? Turns out that this principle of laying down your life, love, as a way to run the show. That by run the show, I mean our families, our churches, our countries. It's this principle is everywhere. That way, in fact, becomes resurrection. So it's a long answer, but I view Trump through the lens of ego, unbridled ego that becomes mad. And frankly, whenever I look at him, the image that comes into my mind most is the Joker from the movie The Dark Knight, or Iago. Othello's Iago. You see, the point about the Joker and Iago is they appear to have no motives except anarchy. It's hard to, when you look at Othello, it's hard to, why does he hate Othello so much? I mean, and the answer is that nihilists and anarchists love anarchy. Now, why do they love anarchy? Why does Trump love chaos? Because he does psychologically love, he thrives on it. Why? Well, there's an answer that I've observed a lot in organizations, which is if I create chaos, I am the solution to that chaos. More chaos, the better. And more unpredictable, the better, because I'm the solution to it all. So chaos is in, and you see it in that phenomenal portrait. Heath Ledger played it and died, unfortunately, soon after, got the Academy Award posthumously of the Joker. More chaos, the better in Gotham City. That's how I view it.
Well, you know, thinking about this systems approach, it seems like it, you know, that at least the the goal that the system that he says he's creating is one that is going to make America great again. It's not a system to make the world not a system to make the world great, but it's a system to you know, to make America America great. And and then within that system, as he's talked about it, we used to, you know, the that search for truth, that there can only be, you know, one person says, well, there's only one truth. It's so we forever in the United States, we've had a two-party, we've had this two-party system, or at least for my whole life. And the idea was that the way that we found truth was in the dialogue between the two parties, that we needed each other. And when I was growing up, the Republicans would say about the Democrats, and the Democrats would say about the Republicans. When I was young, at least, they would say, my colleague across the aisle. And they had a collegial relationship with each other, and they understood somehow that they needed each other, that each perspective was helpful to keep in check the other perspective. But in the run-up to this election, the Trump talked about the Democrats as the enemies of the state, so that there could be no legitimate opposition to him, and that it was he alone who is the one who understands everything. So then he surrounds himself with people who the credentials that they need to surround him are absolute loyalty and fidelity to him. He doesn't want anybody around him that can challenge him as far as knowing more than he does. And as I have studied, I've really depended on the work of Jason Stanley mostly. He wrote the book How Fascism Works. But when you look at all of the characteristics of what Trump is doing, and you look at the characteristics of various fascist regimes in history and currently, they all kind of match up very nicely. And that's what makes this current moment so scary and terrifying. So I just wonder again, you know, how does all of that come across your radar screen?
Well, first of all, let me say that it certainly appears, this may or may not hearten you, that the Trump brand is toxic in Australia. If he were to be elected in Australia, my prediction is he would be, you know, he might get 15% of the vote or something like that. There's something about Australia as a culture. We're a convict culture in a way that America never was. So we're more skeptical of authority figures than I think America is by nature. That's my observation of working in the two countries. We're having an election on Saturday, and we've got, roughly speaking, a right and left wing, roughly speaking, you know, two-party system. The conservatives are in the opposition, and they had they were leading in the polls, but then some of their senior politicians began to invoke Trump language, make Australia great again, and that caused a plunge in their electoral support, such that it looks very likely they're going to lose the election. If Australians smell the Trump factor, it's anathema in general.
Well, that just recently happened in Canada.
That's right. It's the same thing as in Canada. I think of all that you've just said in that question, I mean, what you haven't said, well, two things about America, the American situation, have surprised and appalled me. And they're not about Trump, because there are sociopaths in the world. That's the case. There are people with big egos who trample over other people. And the difference here is that half the country voted for him. That's what I found appalling, not so much Trump, but, and in particular, what I have found sickening is the genuflection of the Republican Party to Trump. And surprising, because I've always valued, like you, a dialogue where the kind of the truth emerges out of a discussion between two forces, and that's been the heart of, I think, a viable democracy. The second thing that's possibly didn't surprise me so much, but is certainly extremely disappointing, is the way white evangelical Christianity has been his power base. And the question that I think needs to be confronted is, how did that happen? Is there something, I mean, that relationship is worth studying, is all I'm saying. And is there something in the belief system of white evangelicalism that predisposed it to a Trump figure?
Well, Kristen Cobe de May wrote the book Jesus and John Wayne, which really describes how in American evangelicalism, the anxiety over manhood has continued to become sharper and sharper, until now we're in American evangelicalism, there is that not just that men need to be good leaders in the home and family, but that men need to be dominant in a certain way. And even that there's a kind of a glorification of violence, that we need violence, that violence is a tool that must be used, and that Christian men must become trained to use that again and must become men again and not back away from that. And when I did my studies on fascism, I discovered that one of the main tenets of fascism is hierarchy, so that the leader of the fascist state is kind of like the ultimate daddy, that he is in charge, and then all the systems underneath that run the same way. There's somebody who is in charge. Each system has a daddy, and it's all very hierarchical. So it's very male based, and so that hierarchical view of the world in fascism fits very well with the hierarchical male view that was growing in evangelicalism. And so I think evangelicals look, especially like a lot of end times thinking, and they look at the state of Israel, and they think that somehow Trump, for all of his failures, is still the man that God has chosen to be a part of the end times plan. And so Trump is the leader that God has given for this time. And so we as evangelical Christians need to follow him. And he's telling us it's time to man up. And this is kind of a war that they're involved with. And what's at stake is the culture, the Christian religion, Western civilization. All of those things are going to all disappear if they don't take charge in this moment and save it. And sometimes that might mean that violence is actually necessary. And all that way of thinking just kind of it all kind of starts blending together.
Well, it does. And I think I think that's a wonderful book, by the way. It's a very sad book, Jesus and John Wayne, and I think she's kind of pessimistic about the situation ever changing. Of course, we need to make the point and bring it right out in the open, going back to where I began. Yeah, what is the moral core of Christianity? What way of living does it describe as the good way of living? And what I said earlier in our discussion is this is actually a very political question. It's not a private morality question. It's political, meaning it has to do with relationships. Because a system is relationships. And Christianity is a relational religion from the word go. Arguably because our picture of God is relational. That's the Trinity. So the overarching question that has to be asked is, so what is the moral core of that relationship? And which will become, what is our picture of God and the good? That's what it'll become. And what I said earlier is the cross is the moral core of Christianity. Now, in traditional evangelical thinking, the cross is an intervention for salvation. And the incarnation is a time-bound event of roughly 33 years. And it leads to what I call the bungee jump model of salvation. God's up there, sees there's a problem on the planet, jumps down, saves us, and goes back to heaven. And they're very, very constrained pictures of the cross and what happened there. As you know, the early church fathers didn't think like that. The incarnation was a principle of creation, where what happened in the Son of God becoming flesh was more the culmination of the whole creation having been to some extent formed and sustained by him. But then the question says, okay, that's good. The incarnation is a revelation. That's what it is. It's a revelation of the moral core of God, the nature of God. And this goes back to this, to the point that I made. The moral core of God is the cross. The cross is not just a means of salvation. It demonstrates the character of God by which he runs everything.
And yeah, I've said that this is kind of condensed theological language, but the cross is the apocalypse of God.
It's the correct. It's the apocalypse of God. So this
means, an apocalypse meaning unveiling.
It's the unveiling. It's the unveiling of God. And it's the unveiling of how God runs things. It's love. And what is, I mean, love, the unfortunate, what has happened, I think, in traditional theology is the picture of God, certainly the picture of God behind hell and the picture of God, the heaven hell, we can get a picture of God as the warrior, the king who rules by violence. And, you know, I think they use a lot of Revelation passages to get to that point. But the real revelation of God from which we must work, around which we must organize our thinking, is no, the kind of love, the definition of love is laying down your life. It's total otherness, total otherness. Now, could I take that into the Jesus and John Wayne story about patriarchy? The Bible says a lot about marriage and the relationship between men and women. Now, for you and I, the book of Ephesians is in many ways the high point of gospel revelation, certainly a candidate. And I love what Tom Wright said, that he often wonders how different the Reformation might have been if Calvin and Luther based their thinking in Ephesians rather than
Galatians. Douglas Campbell has made a similar point, that if we would begin with Ephesians, if Ephesians had been the first of the letters of the Pauline corpus, we might be in a very different.
We might be, because it goes back to where we began. Ephesians is about purpose. And the point about purpose, David, purpose is not a goal. That's very important. It's not a goal. It's not an objective. A purpose is a revelation of my character. What I love. Love would be a better word for, but what am I passionate about? Now, Ephesians is a revelation of the purpose of God and the character of God. The question is, what does Paul say? What is his picture of the character of God? And we know what he says. It comes out in his prayers, because Ephesians is a book that has several very important prayers, because a prayer is important because it means this was the vision and ambition Paul had for his followers to understand. And we know that chapter 3 is the really Mount Everest. He prays you would grasp the love of God. And he doesn't stop there. This love passes understanding. The breadth, the depth, the height of the love of God. So, and this love is evident in the cross. So it's a giving love. It's a total otherness. Now, how then does the book finish in its moral systems? We know where it finishes. We know that the book is framed by the word mystery. A mystery. Something that we've intuited, suspected, can't put words into, stunned us, etc., etc. But the point about the mystery, it is the mystery of the end of all things. Going back to what Vico said, if I get the mystery, what it means is I will get the goal, I'll get the end of all things. Now, you've quoted chapter 1, verse 10, the great recapitulation verse. It's in all wisdom and insight, God has made known to us the mystery of his will. So it's a Christ becoming the epicenter of all reality. And we should read that as Christ on the cross become, that would be the great, you and I both know, when the word mystery returns, chapter 5. It returns in marriage. This is a great, he doesn't say mystery anymore. I think it's the only time he says great mystery. But I am speaking concerning Christ and the church about marriage. What is his picture of marriage? What is his exhortation? It's an anti-patriarchal invocation to a patriarchal society. Lay down, husband, men, lay down your lives for your wife. So it is a, he invokes the cross, the laying down, and he doesn't invoke a warrior manhood. He invokes a manhood that will be much more like the cross. That's the warrior God that we should emulate.
Well, in the Ephesians 1:10, anakephali asostai, that it's recapitulating or putting everything under one head, reconstituting everything under the head of Christ, and in Greek that word is kephala. And kephala can also mean if there was a group of men that was going into battle, the leader would be the kephala. He'd be the point person who would be the first person to bear the brunt of whatever was coming. The kephala went first, not last. Mm-hmm. And kephala is, if you talk about the headwaters of a river, the kephala, the head is the source from which everything good, you know, flows.
Yep.
That's where everything issues forth. So those are both, you know, giving. It's not the image of a guy sitting in a recliner, ordering his wife around to bring him stuff and yelling, you know, barking orders. That's not the kind of image that
it's,
we get there.
I've built my sweet, lovely wife. We have our 50th anniversary this year, David, married 50 years. we got married very young, and we were young and foolish and in love, and she just said how much I'd taught her and how much I'd meant to her over the 50 years. And I've run my life by a principle, and I allude in that St. James Institute talk to the very early stage of my life being framed by grace through my mother, My mother was a saint, and she exemplified the laying down your life. And she also thought marriage was really holy, and she thought of Jesus as her bridegroom. And in our marriage, we're both feisty people, Anne and I. We're strong-minded people. And Anne is somebody, her background is Catholicism. She left Catholicism for an evangelical view of God, but at university. But let's just say she was afflicted by the dark view of guilt and sin and so on. And without going into details, did not have a relationship with her father that was happy, very kind of unfortunate and sort of verbally violent soul. I grew up in a world of grace. I can't remember being criticized, both father and mother. I grew up in an environment of love. So that meant that sometimes in our lives, things would go wrong. I mean, we had four kids in our 20s under 5 years of age. This is a recipe for tension, anxiety, postnatal depression, tough times. And sometimes we'd have, Anne has a volatile temper and she'd, you know, get really cranky at me. And I had to work out how I responded in myself, in my evaluation of what's going on. And all I can say is, and I found myself being at times judgmental of her. You know, done the wrong thing by, you know, throwing the eggs at me as I was walking out, you know, leaving you with the kids. I'm walking out to go to work and you threw the eggs at me. Because I was in my 20s. I didn't even know about postnatal depression. I didn't even think about that, you know. And I'd sort of have this talking to God, well, did you see that happen? Boy, that's pretty bad. And, you know, and surely I'm a better Christian than she is, and it shouldn't be like, you know, this is. And I just had the strong feeling, David, the heavens were brass. God was not listening. And eventually this still quiet voice after some months came back to me. If I ran the universe according to what's going on in your head, where would you be? Your job is to be like me, and your job is to bring grace into the situation by laying down your life. That's actually your job. And so that's how I ran my life. This is very deep for me. This is not a casual thing. And it looks like I'm far from being this male figure who's dominant. It looks like I'm being the weak one. But it brought peace and harmony into our relationship, helped Anne to grow as a person. She's been my rock and brought the best out of her. She's got qualities that I never had. But when she was young, those qualities were sort of being suppressed by negative forces. But now she's behind everything I do. And so when I say that's how you run the show and that's how you run a system, actually I'm talking from that experience. And can I go to just finish on that? Can I go right out from families to MAGA and what's wrong with it? Why it is a unchristian vision?
Go ahead.
It says in Psalm 115, I'm paraphrasing it, but pretty closely, the Lord governs the heavens, but the earth he has given to humanity. The created order is ours to govern in his image. That's the calling. He didn't say he's given America or the UK or Australia the earth. That means every wise Christian needs to have the picture of what's good for the whole, not the part, but what's good for the whole. You just mentioned a very important principle from Ephesians 1 verse 10, which is another principle of systems, that God will recapitulate. He will bring into one, into Christ, all things. So oneness and harmony is a, that is close to the character of God. So what does this mean in a system? It means great systems are ecologies. They are not egotistical. In other words, the smart way to design a system is so that it blesses the systems around it, not just itself. Guess what? At the end of the day, the whole will be better. One of the great limitations of Cartesian reductionism and of poor systems thinking is you manage the part, not the whole. Smart people manage the whole, not the part, and they play a long game. Now, what America did after the Second World War, arguably, was have a, I think, a Christian view of systems thinking. Well, if we bless the world, if we don't make the terrible mistakes that the world made after the First World War, Treaty of Versailles, if we don't crush our adversaries, but we help them. So America, as you probably know, fundamentally helped Japan become the manufacturing colossus it became. You probably don't, or you may or may not know the story, but America sent Edwards Deming, the great statistician who understood what became total quality management. He wasn't listened to in America. They sent him to Japan, and the Japanese listened. So Japanese quality, which became famous, was an American gift to them. And guess what? At the end of the day, as the whole grew, in other words, a world order built on fairness, built on somewhat of otherness, you know, we'll give and we'll take. That's actually how you run the whole show. That's what made America great. And what we're seeing now is an insane logic of egocentricity, non-systemic thinking that will make America small. I mean, America will, I'm sad to say, never recover from this. I think it's opened the door for China to become the moral leader of the world, and economically America will never be trusted again.
Fundamentally it's, if we were, America was what provided stability to the world. Now we've become this unstable country that seems to be having some type of identity crisis, and is not really interested in this role of moral leadership of the whole. We're drawing back into ourselves, and other people around the world look at us, and who can predict what America will be in 5 years or 10 years.
Correct. And
that's a great tragedy that's all been forfeited now.
It is a great tragedy. And I think it's the hope and prayer is that the systems will hold good. At the moment, it seems the battle lines are drawn between the judiciary and the administration. And the hope is that those systems hold good to limit the revenge society that Trump wants to create. Who knows? But unfortunately, very few civilizations last forever. They decline, and that's why our hope is higher than this world.
Right. So let's kind of end on the positive note that we still, even though there are these moments of tyranny. As a matter of fact, in Ilaria Romelli's book on apocatastasis, the big one, she talks about in the ancient world that apocatastasis was about a returning order, so that if an arm was broken, when it was healed and back in working order again, that was an apokatastasis. And when the stars came back around to their original starting point again, you know, that was and the cosmos was this thing that was beautiful and a beautiful. So we get that in the cosmetics, or the cosmos was this beautiful, beautiful ordering of things. And another example of apokatastasis is the return to order after a time of tyranny. And so, you know, we hope for the return to order after this time of building tyranny, but we can trust that there is an overall apokatastasis that is at work, even in the difficult moments that we're going through in this world. So we have this wonderful hope that somehow we're in a system that God has designed to ultimately be triumphant. And so we can weather the storms then that we go through in this life.
That is so true, David, that we, our kingdom is not of this world. And I've thought about that a lot, because I've always feared that the declaration that Jesus is the Lord of the cosmos could be misinterpreted into a kind of a Christian nationalism, that people could take that as a license to that. Well, therefore, we'll run the show now. Now, even if people did believe that, they've got it wrong, because you mentioned that very important word, order. All I would add to that is the source of order is the cross. The order that God always begins with selflessness and other-centered thinking. That's a principle that works everywhere. But I think that our view should, Christians should always view their engagement in the world as salt and light, not as kings. So I've never, ever, ever felt attracted to any political party that named itself as Christian, or any organization that said, look, as a Christian, I do this. I'm much more interested in the invisible influence of salt and light or yeast. That's the nature of our influence in the world. In other words, not taking to ourselves power as Christians, you know, as a Christian theocracy, not doing that, but rather being light in the world that illuminates the true nature of things through the cross and points to the end of all things, which is the new heaven and the new earth, which will be run and governed by Christ as the Lamb of God. And we should...
Right, so yeah, we're not trying to create, Christians shouldn't try to create a fascist kind of state run on violence where the Christians are running everything and it's all Christian. But we should be working side by side with everybody else, bringing together. I never realized how much I valued liberal democracy until I feel like it's starting to slip away from me.
Yeah, I think so. And look, underneath this issue that we're talking about, there's a couple of pretty important points I would like to make before we finish. And they are, first is the role of dialogue in the world, and the second is what order means, what you just mentioned about the cosmos and order. It's terribly important because, yes, the Greek word cosmos actually meant beauty. So the picture of God is a picture of harmony, and David Bentley Hart's very strong about this, as are others, that in Greek mythology and in the ancient world, there was a thought that ultimate reality was a battle between good and evil. So conflict is at the source of reality, and therefore the ultimate I look for will be the triumph of good over evil. So it is a militaristic, aggressive picture of reality. Yet the good wins, but it's a battle. That's ultimate reality. And that was not the Judeo-Christian vision at heart. The ultimate reality is harmony. And this evidenced itself in various doctrines. The most famous of all was the great grasp by the church fathers that evil was not a substance. They were not two equal things, good and evil. Evil was a deprivation. And the best metaphor is it's a very simple one, light and darkness. You know, darkness doesn't exist. It's merely the absence of light. Light does exist. It's mysterious, but it's real. It's waves, you know, particle waves in field. It's real. It frames everything. And when you've got darkness, all you have to do is turn on the light. So this picture of harmony, if this is the picture of the beginning and the end of all things, then this picture of order and cosmos, you know, I like the phrase cosmic redemption rather than universal salvation, because universal mm-hmm. salvation suggests the picture's individual. It's cosmic and it's beautiful and it's order. This does not validate any picture of the final victory being a military victory. The final victory is the harmony of all things, which you've just quoted. So and for your listeners, I would strongly recommend on Gospel Conversations, I interviewed John Walton. Now, you would know John Walton or know of John Walton, I think, from Wheaton, you know, Mr. Old Testament in many ways, Mr. Background. So John has pioneered the archaeological, you're putting the Old Testament into historical context. It's extremely illuminating, and the talks on Gospel Conversations that John gave, and also Ian Proven, who has a similar view. I don't know that either of them are universalists, but they certainly have a view of the cosmos that's very accommodating to what we're talking about. Now, John made a point to me, and I interviewed him about a year or two back on this twice, where there are two interviews, that he said in Genesis 1, in that world, sin and the conquest of sin was not the issue that the ancient mind framed everything around. The issue was order. Order, disorder, and non-order. And he spells them out. It's a breathtaking thing. So the ultimate, let's call them values, were not moral as in good, bad, evil, sin. They were bigger than that, framed around order. And our job as humanity on the planet and as Christians is to bring order, to bring beauty into situations. That's what he was saying. And the power of that interview is order, disorder, and non-order. In other words, it includes moral evil, but it includes tsunamis, it includes illness, it includes the whole spectrum of disorders that don't have a moral cause. Very powerful. So I'd recommend that one. So that's the first point I wanted to make about order. And I want to stress what I've said, that the absolutely unique, breathtaking, unexpected picture of governance and kingship that Jesus introduced is it'll be by laying down your life. It's cross-based order. And when I say cross-based, we must include the resurrection, because the resurrection is a victory of unimaginable scope, far bigger scope than a warrior defeating another one. And it's the death of death, and the two are united. The other thing I wanted to make, there's a third thing I wanted to say just quickly before we finish. But the second thing has to do with dialogue. There's an undercurrent in what we've talked about, which is fundamentalism. I fear fundamentalism greatly. And many religions, and so fundamentalism can exist anywhere, and it becomes essentially a demagogue. My right way. So fundamentalism is the bedrock of dictatorship and fascism. The question, and I think that's unfortunately the evangelical, the white evangelical movement in America is predisposed to compliance with a dictator figure because of its veering towards a fundamentalist version of Christianity. And if you wanted to say, well, what's the alternative to fundamentalism? What I would say is that fundamentalism is a fused picture of God. It's actually, let's say, an Islamic picture of God. And if you think about that picture of one right way, only one right way, well, the operation of that God will become dictatorship to my one right way. My criticism of fundamentalism is not a Trinitarian model. And this is too big a topic for us to go into at the moment, but I don't know if you're familiar with John Frame's normative situational existential framework. Well, we could perhaps have another talk about it, but essentially the Trinity is not a fundamentalist model of God. It's a model of dialogue. It's a model of otherness that John Frame, in his famous book, The Doctrine of the Knowledge of God, developed extensively using a model called the normative, the situational and the existential, which as a Christian is a phenomenal heuristic or model that lets me believe in normative things but be adaptive and listen to other people. Which is the heart of democracy, which is a respectful forum to discuss and to explore things, which Christianity has at its best been good at, but frankly, the closer it got to the state, the more it lost it. And von Balthasar said it all began in the 5th century. And the only other thing is, which I would have loved to talk about, is I actually think a lot of the themes we've been talking about, who runs the show? How do you run the show? I think there is a pre-shadowing of the battle at the cross in the temptation, Jesus and Satan, because Satan is running the show. And that really bears thinking about in terms of the issues we've been talking about fascism. I mean, Satan's a fascist. And that temptation was stunningly the basis of Dostoevsky's great chapter called The Grand Inquisitor in The Brothers Karamazov.
Well, in a way, this has been sort of a long reflection on the nature of power and how it's used and what its ends and purposes are. And we can certainly see ways that it can be misused, but it can still be used well. And the kingdom of God is still here. The power of God's ruling, reigning power of love is still, we can still embrace it. The way of Christ is still available to us. So we can still live in that kingdom in this world, and we can finally trust that power of love will be invincible. And so we can hold on and just do the best that we can as we try to bring as much order as we can to this world through the loving power of Christ.
Amen. That's a great way to close the discussion. And I like your summary. It's been a discussion about power and the nature of power. Where apocatastasis fits in is that the picture of the end and therefore the picture of the beginning shines a light on the nature of that power. And I mean, my theme has been that Christ inverted all the paradigms of power we've got. available to us.
Right. Well, it's been a joy speaking with you, and I hope people will go to Gospel Conversations. And I really enjoyed your talk that you gave at the St. James Institute. I hope people will go and listen to that. And look forward to future conversations with you, Tony. Appreciate you.
Okay, David. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.